radio world. You're listening to the premiere episode of Movie Land with me, your host, Casey. This being the first episode, I want to just give a bit of an introduction. I think of Movie Land as like an amusement park, like a really fun amusement park where I get to tour bus you from one attraction to the next. The attractions being movies or films, whatever you want to call them, and we can get into that distinction later. And the music, noises, sounds, conversations, and the moments in them that are just so delicious, and just want to play them over and over for you again. These moments outside of their context in a different space altogether through the radio world, the radio airwaves, in appreciation of how they work and how they function so well within our imagination and memory of that context of those movies is what I'm trying to do here. All right, so today is episode 1, and I've decided to start it as a Christmas episode. Everyone has their go-to Christmas movies, and there are so many factors that determine which get viewed, right, every year. I think of Christmas as a movie marathon time, and as a kid, I remember, like, Batman Returns. Probably that was my first movie that I saw in Canada on TV, Batman Returns, and the Die Hards, and the Home Alones, and anything Jim Carrey, basically, starting with the mask. There was this one time a few years ago when I thought it'd be a really good idea to watch Ace Ventura 2 with my then-boyfriend and his parents, and that was really not well received, but I had a good time. So anyway, but if I had to choose a top three list, three, because I can only imagine sitting through three in one day, they would have to be Stanley Kubrick's The Shining, and then Chris Noonan's Babe, yes, the pig movie, and then Tokyo Story by Yasujiro Ozu. There are so many films, right? And I just, like, I couldn't help myself. I had to come up with, like, an alternate version of maybe a Boxing Day movie marathon or, like, a New Year's Day super hungover movie marathon. And that one would have to include Stanley Kubrick's Eyes Wide Shut, the Coen brothers' Big Lebowski, and a very sumptuous noir like Mildred Pierce or The Big Sleep. So yeah, those would be my holiday side A's and side B's. And this week on Movie Land, the premiere episode, I'm going to play you my side A's, starting with Stanley Kubrick's The Shining. So sometimes Christmas to me is the same as Halloween. You know, you've got the costumes, you have the junk food, I guess. I was going to say candy, but in the spirit of a good time, good, wholesome, creepy, happy time. The first thing I'm going to play is It's Halloween by The Shakes, just because it's a great song for either occasion, for any time of the year, from their beautiful album Philosophy of the World. I would be so happy if the band had the whole album remixed with tambourine on all the tracks and re-released it with the same cover wearing photoshopped Santa hats. So here we go. It's Halloween.
Why, even Dracula will be there.
It's time for games, it's time for fun. Not for just one, but for everyone. The Dracolances are all lit up. All the dummies are made and stuff. By just looking, you will see. It's his time of year again. It's Halloween, it's Halloween. All the kids are happy and gay. There doesn't seem to be a cloud in their way. But when it's over, they can't.
Dies Irae, Latin for Day of Wrath. It's a hymn that's used in the Requiem Mass for the Dead, depicting the end of the world, and is the opening theme to the film. Very, very auspicious start. The opening credits are so epic, like this crazy swooping, nauseating aerial shot of the Rockies in Glacier National Mountain Park in Montana. And it's the point of view is from, it seems like, you know, omnipotent, like, drone, god, helicopter, predator bird, and it just swoops in and follows the Torrance family vehicle as they begin their winter getaway to the Overlook Hotel. So The Shining is, like all other Kubrick films, a film adapted from a novel. And I think the word genius is pretty apt to describe Kubrick, even though it's such a dubious word, as it isolates and raises the qualities of an individual into some grandiose mythic realm outside of their contemporaries, their collaborators, supporters, community, especially in such a collaborative medium, such a collaborative, hyped up industry, capitalist medium as mainstream film. But I still think he's a genius. And the Kantian idea of a genius is someone who is a human embodiment of a natural force. And I'm quoting here an art writer, Boris Groys, from his essay called Art and Money, which you can find with a quick Google. And to me, this is a beautiful idea, an ideal of an idea, beautifully put, and just so true to Kubrick, a human embodiment of a natural force. If not genius, then just like someone who is completely aware and in tune with the universe they're creating, not just in the film itself as a finished thing, but in the backstories and the back histories around that universe that, like, we the viewers will never get to see. And that's what a director should have, that knowledge, that omnipotence. Here is a clip from The Shining, one of my favorite moments.
By the hair on your chinny chin chin. Then I'll huff, and I'll puff, and I'll blow your house in.
If you have not seen this movie, you have to see this movie. Any time of the year, any time of the day. It works on so many levels, too, inviting multiple interpretations, whether your angle of entry is ideological or aesthetic. My reading of the film is that there is an entanglement of personal guilt, fear, and madness in the Torres family, with the larger societal guilt, fear, and madness that comes with all of the crazy ghost baggage that the Overlook Hotel represents. Jack Nicholson is a struggling writer and a recovering alcoholic, and there is like definite tension between him and Wendy from the get-go. And Danny seems to be hiding some sort of trauma through talking to and through his imaginary friend Tony, his little finger friend. Whether it was physical or sexual abuse is unclear, but there's definitely something there from the beginning. And I think in the book, Jack broke Danny's arm one time when he found Danny leafing through his papers or something. And the way he tells it in his mind, because he was super blasted when he did it, is like he just tried to pull Danny away from his desk, and just being an adult and a little kid, and he used too much force, and his wife Wendy never forgave him for that. Like every time she looked at him, he would just see that memory and kind of manifest in just like the air between them. So this dark history of the family is brought to the Overlook, a getaway destination in Colorado that is designed in a modern American lushness with Native American motifs. Beautiful and rich and lush, but sinister in the colonial history of the hotel. It is on a Native American burial ground. And at one point, Jack mentions the white man's burden, the title line from the Kipling poem, while talking to the ghost butler, Grady, in the bathroom. And here, this is about midway through the film, Jack is about to lose it. Like, up until then, he's kind of holding together. Things are kind of tense, but okay, things are kind of creepy at the hotel. Danny sees a ghost or two. Wendy's kind of lonely, and everything's really just quiet, and the snow's starting to come down. But this is where he truly loses it. Here is a man who is trapped in a hotel, bored out of his mind. He hates his family. He hates himself. He has a writer's block. He's supposed to be, you know, creative. He has no booze, no creative juice. And then this nice music comes on as he's walking through the hotel, and he finds himself not so alone. That was Al Boley and the Ray Noble Orchestra performing Midnight, the Stars, and You, a song from the film The Shining. And I just want to recontextualize that song within the scene of the film once more with feeling.
Good to be back, Lloyd. Butler's pizza. Hair of the dog that bit me.
Bourbon on the rocks.
That'll do it.
No charge to you, Mr. Torrance.
No charge? Your money's no good here. Orders from the house. Orders from the house. Drink up, Mr. Torrance. I'm the kind of man likes to know who's buying their drinks, Lloyd.
It's not a matter that concerns you, Mr. Torrance. At least not at this point.
Anything you say, Lloyd. Anything you say.
So now we see Grady, the ghost butler, waiter character in this dream scene, basically, spill some cocktails on Jack's jacket, and then they head to the bathroom, and he cleans them off, and he suggests that he kill his family, yada, 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 more craziness. Okay. There's so many things I enjoy about this film, and one of them is Kubrick's doubling and mirroring technique, both formally in his mise-en-scene and in the narrative throughout the film, where he plants certain objects and motifs throughout that are very subtle but become significant to us later on. Spectacle Theater in Brooklyn did this thing in 2011, and I would love to see it here. They presented the film doubly projected, playing forwards and simultaneously backwards without the backwards audio. It's the scariest, most poetic kind of visual matchups, like the film speaking to each other front and back. It's its own thing. To me, that attests to the idea of genius, that the film is somehow in touch with nature in a way outside of the creator. It works on some level beyond immediate cognition. I think even Kubrick would have been surprised by it. I just wanted to play a snippet from an interview with Kubrick himself from 1980.
After Barry Lyndon, I've never had another film clearly in mind as I was making a film. Whenever I finish a film, I just start to read. It wastes a lot of time. I wish I could make films more often. But this just came. It must have been 4 or 5 months after the film came out. I don't find any systematic way of reading. It's a terrifying prospect to and realize all the books there are in the world that you're never going to read. So what you should read. So I find by just reading at random, that seems like the best approach. Well, in this case, it was the fiction. Just like everybody else, I'm fascinated by the various experiments and the stories which have been published about ESP and you know, psychokinesis. But it certainly didn't start with a desire to do something on that subject. The book was sent to me in a manuscript form by John Kelly. I've always enjoyed the genre, and I felt that I hadn't really seen a picture that presented, you know, that genre. There have been pictures which have had shocks in them and which have had some wonderfully gory or horrific moments, but to properly, you know, present the, you know, that type of a story in a way where you could disbelief and get involved in the story, and you know, the supernatural events were presented in a way you know, which seemed dramatically realistic. What I found so so ingenious about the way the novel was written, as the various supernatural events occurred, you always wonder to yourself, how is the writer ever going to explain this? The way the story is written, you assume as you read it that the things that are happening are probably going to be a product of his imagination. And I think this allows you to start accepting them and not worry. It isn't really until the bolt is open that you're absolutely certain that it isn't a product of imagination, because he couldn't open the bolt. The writing was marvelous, so that the characters were particularly well presented. In a story like this, it didn't really matter that the plot was the cardinal point, and that characterization and everything else, when you make a movie out of it, could be, you know, improved. There's no doubt that I think that both novelists and filmmakers, Leo, consciously or unconsciously, are encountering the problem of what importance is a story. Is it more than just a way of keeping people's attention while you exercise the more subtle aspects of the medium that you're working with? Or is the story the most important thing, or is the story just holding your interest? Execution of the art form becomes the what the artist is interested in. I think that realistic fiction and realistic drama must be encountering some limits now, where people feel that
is quite the dilemma he brings up. I guess it's an ongoing struggle, that tension between the medium, the form, the art form, and the plot. And I guess, what is plot? Is it its own art? Just like a decoy, or something to hold the audience's attention to really reveal the actual art itself? It's not a distraction. It's inherently part of it. But how much importance is it within the movie, within the theater, within that 3-hour period you give it? You choose to believe that this is happening. Sustained disbelief. And I love that. I love how he starts the interview off saying that he feels intimidated by all that he will never read. And he refers to his films as pictures, which is interesting because it's quite literally what film is, a series of still pictures. And that distinction, going back and forth between saying movie and saying film, is something I always like stutter through in my head. Like, oh, what I want to say about the film, if I'm talking about it seriously in my head, makes it a film. And if I'm thinking about it in more like a casual way, like watching it on a date or like at a bar, when you watch movies at a bar, but like, you know, in a more casual setting, then I think movie. And it's not even really about the picture itself. It's about the context in which I'm like viewing it. So anyway, so some good bio bits on Kubrick I want to just like touch upon, because he's such an interesting character. He was born in the Bronx. He grew up in New York and did really poorly in high school. Like, I think he graduated with like a 60 average or something, couldn't get into college, but really liked physics and became a really good chess hustler in New York while he photographed for Look magazine. And then he worked on this serial TV documentary series called The March of Time before making his first films. And then throughout his career, you know, got sick of Hollywood, got sick of New York, was afraid of, like, it became too dangerous in New York, and America became too dangerous altogether for him during the 60s. And then he moved to England he went to England to make Dr. Strangelove, and then he decided to stay there after because he just thought America was too dangerous because of the Cold War. And he bought a huge estate there. And the chess and the physics make sense to me in how much of a calculating mastermind he is when he's creating his filmic worlds. There's this BBC documentary called Stanley Kubrick's Boxes, where the director and narrator, John Ronson, he goes into his storage room years after his death and pulls out boxes and boxes and boxes of meticulous research. Ronson talks to a location scout for Eyes Wide Shut. I think it was like Kubrick's nephew or something. And Stanley had his nephew go around town taking photographs of every gate of every mansion as to find the right one for the film. And same with like interiors of New York bars or foyers of lobbies of apartment buildings. Just like so methodical, meticulous, based in reality, not from like an imagination, but from the real world, and like finding that average in between them all that represents the real world the best. That's like his approach. Another good example is having one of his research assistants finding out the exact temperature and humidity of the days during which the film takes place from the previous year, kind of like a farmer's almanac kind of style. And so those, these tidbits are from his shooting of Eyes Wide Shut. And more on that next week here on Movie Land when I talk about my side Bs. One last thing before moving on Kubrick here in The Shining. I found this interview with Jack Nicholson, and he's recalling talking to Kubrick about the film. And Kubrick tells him that in some way, The Shining is an optimistic kind of movie. And Jack's like, what do you mean? And Stanley responds, well, it's a film about ghosts, so in the film there's life after death, and that's optimistic. And that to me is such a like funny, rational way of thinking about this film. And when I saw it for the first time, I couldn't sleep for like days. Those two little girls, like every time I went to the bathroom, walking down the very small hallway of my parents', you know, basement suite when I was a kid, just freaked me out so much. And home is where the fear is, I guess. And we're going to end the Kubrick segment with a song called Home by Henry Hall and his Glen Eagles Hotel Band. And he's performing here with the singer Maurice Elwin. And this is also one of these old jazzy 1930s special coffee tunes.
Thank you. 30 years, there has been one voice in the local Vancouver art scene that has stood above the rest, and that's Discorder, that conspiracy, punk rock, foxcore, sassy, still publishing magazine from CITR. We're one of the established and trusted voices of Vancouver's music and arts culture in the Lower Mainland, with 8,000 copies distributed monthly to over 135 distribution locations, from the Lido to Zulu Records.
Discorder is one of a few magazines published by a community radio station, and we only serve up the freshest local and Canadian goods.
We have interviews with artists, album reviews, live show reviews, and articles about everything important to our crazy, unique, varied, and amazing culture in Vancouver and across the country.
Pick up your free copy of Discorder today, or sign up to have it delivered to your door wherever you are.
Check out our website for distribution locations and all the information about advertising and getting involved with Discorder.
What is this?
CITR 101.9 FM.
A center for ants?
What?
We're a radio station broadcasting from UBC Vancouver.
How can we be expected to teach children to learn how to read if they can't even fit inside the building?
Visit CITR.ca.
Derek, it's just a...
I don't want to hear your excuses! The center has to be at least... 3 times bigger than this!
Welcome back to Movie Land on CITR 101.9 FM. And I'm your host, Casey. On today's premiere episode, I'm going through my holiday side A, that is, the movies I'd watch on Christmas. I started with The Shining, spent like half an hour on The Shining. I think I mentioned this earlier, Kubrick only ever made films from books, and I really love that literary approach. My favorite kind of art always comes from a place outside of art, and I get medium specificity within the historical context, like abstract painting during the 50s, New York, and the Cold War, or structuralist films, also in New York in the 50s. But today, the digitization of every cultural thing makes information itself a medium. Like here I am, collaging together bits of information for you. Okay, one more digression, because I also really love Quentin Tarantino films, and I'm so excited for The Hateful Eight, which I'm going to go see on Christmas Day, actually, 2 p.m. and 70 mil. Oh my God, that's like the Christmas present to myself. I was listening to the Bret Easton Ellis podcast, the writer of American Psycho, and he talks about movies a lot and is very invested in the debate of ideology versus aesthetics, especially within Hollywood. And the latest episode I heard featured Tarantino as a guest. The two just completely nerd out about films and the culture and the industry of it. And at one point, Tarantino says when he writes his scripts, he thinks of them as novels. And there's no way, actually, for some of the prose to be explicitly translated into the film. Like, for instance, there's a scene he wrote in Kill Bill when the bride comes out of her coma and goes searching for some buried revenge booty in the desert, like money, passports, weapons, that kind of thing that she hid away before she thought, you know, stuff would go down. And she finds the rock she had marked, and she had buried the stuff like 100 paces from that rock. And the line in the screenplay he wrote was, "She turns over the rock, finds the X. If the X hadn't have been there, if she couldn't find the rock, she would have taken it as a sign that her revenge was never supposed to happen." And Tarantino fans on the internet get into a huff about that. Like, why did he write it that way? No one really could understand that in the movie. Nobody got that when they were watching it. But that to me is the best. Like, the stuff you don't know in the finished work. Maybe on some subconscious level, it was really, really important that the actors read that line, and it kind of colored the way they play the character, you know, so you do in the end see it in some way. That to me is, the process is something, whether it's a film or a song or a novel, is long and hard and should be meticulous if it's, you know, worth being your favorite anything. Like, it's the studio version of a Cocteau Twins song, and then the live version. It's the mirepoix of that braised beef dish you don't even know that was like a necessary step. And I just brought up the Cocteau Twins because there's one of my favorite songs. There's the studio recording of Sugar Hiccup. There's like a BBC live performance version of Sugar Hiccup. And then some wonderful human being uploaded a live version from their show at the Orpheum in 1991. There's a performance of that version of Sugar Hiccup. And I'm going to play it for you now. Christmas is Halloween again. So beautiful, so nice, that golden note. And like, I try to find different recordings where they hit that golden tone and like repeatedly, but I can't. It's just in this live version that you hear it so well. Anyway, that was my Cocteau Twins and Tarantino digression. And moving on, like I said, I thought about putting Pulp Fiction on my Christmas side A's, but honestly, my gut is to go with Babe. the movie about a pig who did. It's amazing. It's so good. Babe has like a little goatee on his head, like a little tuft of hair. Just imagining them trying out the little goatee on the pig actor, watching it every time, I'm like, how much of this is them getting the animals to move in the right way, and how much of it is CGI? So effective. It won the Oscar for Best Special Effects that year, beating out Apollo 13. Not a very good movie. So this one time, like 10 years ago, this is a personal story about why Babe means so much to me for Christmas. So like 10 years ago, I was on a plane to Australia to visit family for Christmas, and we had a 36-hour layover in Hawaii. I was 20, hadn't been to America before, and had never really eaten blue cheese before. And with 36 hours, we had time to stay overnight in Waikiki in a hotel and be tourists for a little bit. And right before going to catch our connecting flight to Sydney, we were walking around and decided to go to an IHOP for food. And I decided to order a blue cheese mandarin orange spinach salad. And it came with like the horrible tin canned baby orange segments, you know? It was the most disgusting thing I've ever eaten, and to this day, like 10 years later, I can't do blue cheese. Even like the creamy Camembert blues with honey, pine nuts, pear, that kind of thing. Like, I understand why it's delicious. I really do, but I just can't. Like, my body, my memory just can't deal with it. Anyway, so I eat the salad. I kind of just like make myself eat it, but it's so disgusting. And then we go to the airport, and at the airport, I have a Diet Pepsi. Maybe I have two Diet Pepsis. And then we board and we're seated at the back of the plane. And the moment we begin to take off, I start barfing uncontrollably. The flight's at night. It's dark. But through like the red blinking lights that I can sort of like see flash on and off outside the plane, between that like dim red light, I can see what I'm barfing up. And it's the color of Diet Pepsi speckled with chunks of blue cheese. I barfed all the way as we ascended using my barf bag and the person next to me's barf bag. And the stewardess had to come give me a new bag and take my old one and like give me some gravel and some water while the seatbelt sign was still on. We were still kind of not, you know, at the right level yet. Oh my God, it was so awful. It was so traumatic. It was like a body trauma. And then after I kind of get settled down a little, I just feel like I had the wind knocked out of me or something, you know? And I turn on the little screen on the seat in front of me, and what is playing? It's Babe. It's Babe. And I watched the movie all the way through, and something about flying and barfing and the whole thing made me cry basically the entire time, all the way through the movie. The funny parts, the sad parts, the inspiring parts, the like the mundane parts, every single thing just made me cry. When Farmer Hoggett sings "If I Had Words" to the pig, oh my God, it was the most heart-melting thing I had ever seen.
I'd sing you a morning golden and true. I would make this day last for all time, then fill the night deep in moonshine. If I had words to make a day for you, I'd give you a morning golden and true. I would make this day last for all time.
Without the help and support of our friends, we here at CITR wouldn't be able to bring you all the great music, art, cinema, and culture that you love. Thanks to the long-standing support from the Rio Theater, we are able to keep you informed on all the great artists, films, and everything else coming to town there. For all the current information about who and what's playing at the Rio Theater, visit their website at www.riotheater.ca.
A stack of records here, a stack of records there. I got records scattered all over everywhere, but I'm looking.
Discorder Magazine has been supporting independent music for over 30 years, and it keeps on living by joining efforts with local music supporters such as Vinyl Records. You can find a selection of Vinyl Records' featured albums on the back cover of Discorder and can support your favorite local bands and artists by purchasing their records. For more information on their vast selection of new, used, and rare music, go to vinylrecords.ca.
Movie Land on CITR 101.9 FM. I'm your host, Casey, and I'm here to finish off this premiere episode, this premiere Christmas episode. Today, I've been going through my Christmas Side A films, and I've limited myself to three, because I think I can only conceivably watch three movies in a row without needing to stop and maybe talk to a human being. And so far, I've talked about Stanley Kubrick's The Shining and Chris Noonan's Babe. The last film on my list is Tokyo Story, or Tokyo Monogatari, a 1953 Japanese film by my most favorite of all directors, Yasujiro Ozu. And to kick it off, I'm going to play the theme from the film, played in its opening credits. It is just called the Tokyo Story theme by Kojin Saito. That beginning. It's springtime.
Thank you.
it ends with winter. Okay, first I want to do a little introduction on Ozu. I know I didn't do an introduction for Chris Noonan, but I mean, I don't know, like, Ozu is one of my favorites, and so is Kubrick. So anyway, and I do what I want. It's my show. So Ozu, he is someone I will definitely return to in the future, so I don't want to go too in-depth right now. So one of the qualities I appreciate most in film and in any art is the rigor and the discipline exercised by the artist, their commitment to the project and to their practice. And Ozu, like, does that. He made 63 films in his 60 years of life. And his films are so disciplined that film theorists have written books on their semiotics, their syntax, the grammar of his visual language, his pacing, his editing, his shooting style, the way he frames, the like closeness to the actors, his sets, his films, his scores, like every little detail has been kind of studied because it's so, he did it for 63 films, kind of the same thing. He did it that much. He was born on December 12th, 1903, and he died December 12th, 1963, living a perfect 60 years. He had siblings, a couple of siblings. He went to school and was kicked out of his dorm when he was 17 for allegedly writing a love letter to another boy. He served in the military for a brief time and started working for Shochiku Film Company as an assistant to the cinematographer in 1923. And pre-World War II, he made period dramas with a focus on the lives of samurai. Jidageki, they were called. And it's easy to see how these period films influenced Kurosawa and Mizoguchi, two other revered Japanese filmmakers from the same era. But Ozu was more interested in the portrayal of the daily life and the mundane events of daily life rather than the kind of glorified action of samurai and Ronin existence itself. The portrayal of daily family life would become his central thematic once he moved up in the company. But during his 30s at Shochiku, he met Kogo Noda, who he worked on scripts with for the rest of his life. So the two formed a very, very strong bond there. And the two of them would get blasted while writing, usually at the same hotel. That's like the ritual. They would write this one hotel. And Onoda recalls that they'd measure the progress of the script they were working on in the number of empty sake bottles. There are a lot of Ozu films in which a similar narrative plays out, like children grow up, get married, parents get old, colleagues reminisce over the good old days of their youth, but not really, because the good old days meant the war. And in Tokyo Story, the narrative is of an old married couple who live in the countryside going to visit their now grown-up kids in Tokyo. And when the parents arrive, the kids are too busy to actually hang out with them, with the exception of Noriko, played by the wonderful, amazing, beautiful Setsuko Hara. She plays the wife of the parents' deceased son from the war. And while the other children treat their visiting parents kind of coldly, as if they were a nuisance, she extends herself as much as possible to make their visit a satisfying and happy one. At one point, the father and mother, they sit there fanning themselves in the heat in summer, and they talk about their children, how they used to be nicer, but trying really hard not to be negative in any way. They reassure themselves that their kids are luckier and better off than most. And you get a sense that they are telling themselves this while thinking about the war, about their son who died during it, about Noriko, who's, you know, technically not their daughter, but who treats them like her parents. They talk in this slow, calm cadence, one repeating what the other has just said in agreement, fanning themselves very slowly in the summer heat as if like meditating on these niceties that they're politely repeating over and over to themselves, maybe to make believe into belief. We can't expect too much, the dad says. We're lucky, the mom says. And many of Ozu's films are named with a season in the title, like early spring, late spring, early summer, and autumn afternoon. There are many like this. And like the passing of the seasons, his films poetically arrange the passing of time through these very humanistic and mundane stories of ordinary people, like the parents just sitting there talking about their kids growing up. That happens to everyone, And it's so mundane, but we can all relate to it. The aesthetic of Ozu's films become refined and recognizable over time. There's framing happening within the shot itself as much of the action happens in the Japanese home. Rooms upon raised floors on the tatami mat. He was known for his tatami shot, where the camera would be at the height of someone seated on the tatami mat, and so much of the shooting would be done with the camera person lying stomach down on the floor. I remember reading somewhere that one of his cameramen died of stomach cancer, and then, you know, you kind of want to find the relationship there. Back to Tokyo Story itself, there are so many beautiful and poignant moments in the narrative. I would play more clips, but it's in Japanese, so I don't want to, like, dub it. I don't know if it hits an especially, like, tender nerve for me because I'm Asian. I'm not Japanese, but I'm Chinese, and there are many family dynamics I recognize. But at the same time, I think Ozu's films transcend their historical specificity. Like just the parents talking about kids growing older, that happens to everyone, whether we see it or not, whether the parents are together or not. I mean, most people can relate to that idea of people they care about growing up, growing older, becoming different. And that's not, that can't be measured in terms of good or bad. It's just something that happens, right? And good and bad is context. Like, their son in the film is a doctor, and that's good. But he's not a doctor in the big city. He's actually a family doctor in the suburbs and has to pay house calls, like, every day, like an on-call family doctor. And that's not as good as they had thought, but it's still good because, unlike their dead son, he's alive and has a family. That's great, but he has his own family and is too busy to take care of his parents who took care of him. That's not so great. So it's like this weird balancing scale. All these, like, things come into effect in your mind all the time because we all know that, like, the underlying, like, subtext and backstory there, we all kind of know already. And what's relative and what's universal is entangled. And the way Tokyo Story and many, like, of his other films show these entanglements in neat, timed, precisely calculated blocks of mundane action is super elegant and so graceful and super Japanese to me. Like, I think of, like, flower arranging or bonsai. I mean, it's not so restrained and torturous as bonsai, but just, like, the composition of everything just so is very, it's very Japanese. And I think Wes Anderson does this in his films, and I think Lars von Trier does this too, in these small, subtle moments of reveal, like a sleight of hand trick that sneak up and surprise you, stun you, move you unexpectedly. And Tokyo Story and all of Ozu's films are filled with these reveals, as that's what I would call them. And Tokyo Story happens to be playing at the Cinematheque this week as a part of their Christmas programming, and I really hope you get to see it. It's also on YouTube, but of course, that's not the same thing. Well, radio world, that's it for my holiday side A. Next time, I'll be back with my side B, which will include Kubrick's Eyes Wide Shut, The Big Lebowski, and The Big Sleep, or Mildred Pierce, haven't decided. Maybe both. I'm going to leave you with the opening scene to Tokyo Ga, a film by Wim Wenders he made in 1985, in which he goes to Japan on this romantic pilgrimage to connect in some way to the Japan of Ozu's films, in Ozu's imagination, and to see and experience what it might have been like 30 years later. And he puts everything I've just said very beautifully in his own very German way. And here is the opening scene from Tokyo Ga.
If in our century there were still sacred things, if there were something like a sacred treasure of the cinema, then for me that would have to be the work of the Japanese director Yasujiro Ozu. He made 54 films, silent films in the 20s, black and white films in the 30s and 40s, and finally color films until his death on December 12, 1963, on his 60th birthday. With extreme economy of means and reduced to but the bare essentials, Ozu's films again and again tell the same simple story, always of the same people in the same city, Tokyo. This chronicle, spanning nearly 40 years, depicts the transformation of life in Japan. Ozu's films deal with the slow deterioration of the Japanese family, and thereby with the deterioration of a national identity. But they do so not by pointing with dismay at what is new, Western or American, but by lamenting with an unindulged sense of nostalgia the loss taking place at the same time. As thoroughly Japanese as they are, these films are at the same time universal. In them I've been able to recognize all families in all the countries of the world, as well as my parents, my brother, and myself. For me, never before and never again since, has the cinema been so close to its essence and its purpose, to present an image of man in our century, a usable, true, and valid image, in which he not only recognizes himself, but from which, above all, he may learn about himself.
This goes out to Donny Hathaway and his beautiful family. This Christmas, baby. Yeah. This Christmas, baby. That's what I'm talking about. Check it out, baby.
Hang all the mistletoe. I'm gonna get to know.
You better, baby.
This Christmas, as we trim the tree.
How much fun is gonna be? And cards are here. My world is filled with cheer.